What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. On this week's show, we'll continue our look back at some of our favorite music and interviews from 2023, including keyboardist Rodney Stepp and Ellen Turk Burke of the Spinners, and vocalist Debbie Nelson. In November of 2023, the Spinners were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Spinners rose to prominence with Motown Records in the 1960s, but very few music fans know about the Spinners' Naptown connection. WFYI's Kyle Long recently spoke with two Indianapolis music legends who were part of the Spinners. Ellen Turk Burke, who worked as a keyboardist and music director with the Spinners for over 25 years, and Rodney Stepp, who served as keyboardist and assistant music director for the Spinners from 1974 until 1981. Let's listen back to an excerpt of their conversation.
I'm Ellen Burke, nicknamed Turk, and I go way back with the Spinners into the mid-60s.
And my name is Rodney Stepp, and I go way back with Turk, because he was my mentor and my leader and my inspiration. So, hey, that's who we are.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your individual work with the Spinners today. The Spinners were first formed in Ferndale, Michigan in 1954. Next year will be the 70th anniversary of the founding of the group. And one of the original founders of the Spinners was Billy Henderson, who was born here in Indianapolis in 1939. And throughout the group's history, they always maintained some connections with Indianapolis, pretty significant connections. And we're going to talk about that today. Obviously, the Spinners were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and this was a huge moment for the group and brought them back into the spotlight. As we get started, I just wanted to hear each of you kind of give your thoughts on seeing the Spinners, your former band, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I think it's an awesome thing that they're finally getting the recognition that they've deserved for so long as a group.
And how long were you with the Spinners in total? I've heard over 23 years. Is that right? Roughly 23?
It's over that. With the, if you add the years in the 60s that I played with them, Rodney and I will both talk about that. I first started touring with them in the 70s and then went back in the 80s for 20 more years. So it's about 25, 26
wow.
years.
It's incredible. Rodney, how did you feel when you heard they were getting inducted, and how has this moved you seeing this happen?
Oh, man, I tell you what, it was awesome for me, because that's an incredible feat. I mean, that's just history, legendary. And then me to feel like, hey, I was a part of this, whether I was included or not, it didn't even matter, you know, because I know we were a major part of that history. And as you look at, and I'm so happy for the guys, it, to me, it took too long. I wish it had been sooner, like Turk said, because we've lost so many of them. I mean, basically four out of the five are gone.
There's a lot of politics in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, especially as it relates to who gets invited to these ceremonies. I remember when the Ink Spots were inducted back in the 90s, the only Indianapolis group to make it to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They didn't invite Jerry Daniels, who was one of the four founding members of the group. Mm. Did you guys feel like slighted, or did you have any sense of bitterness about that at all?
I would have loved to have been there, but I didn't want to get involved in those politics. It was kind of surprising how all that came about, because we did witness some other people that are really close to the group and very important members that helped in their history on their rise not be able to be there. But like Rodney said, I was just so proud for them and knowing that we had a big part on them. Rodney was on the biggest stages with them, and I have a lot of time with them. So we're proud ourselves for them.
Before we get into your individual histories with the group, let's talk about some of those Indianapolis musicians. I was trying to think of Rodney Voorhees, Larry King, was Miles Butch Lloyd part of the group? Tell me about those guys, and who am I forgetting?
Yeah, we had Rodney Voorhees on bass. We even had Jerry Miller on guitar, Bobby Gayhart on drums. We had Miles Lloyd on organ and keys. Larry King, of course, ended up with them, as well as the OJ's and Sister Sledge. Mm-hmm. And I'll take credit for that. Mm-hmm. I got him the gig, both gigs, because I was out on the road and the OJ's needed a bass player. And I said, hey, I got a friend, mm-hmm. you know.
You mentioned you had a cousin that played with him, too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. How can I forget that? Mike Simmons played with Turk. Turk hired Mike. And and Mike, of course, is the older brother of Bill Simmons, my cousin from Midnight Star.
Yeah. So did we forget any?
It's all entwined.
Yeah.
Turk, did we forget any Indianapolis players that were
I don't think
with the
so. I was going through it, and actually a couple of names that Rodney had mentioned, I was, oh, yeah, he was with the group, too. Yeah.
And a lot of these guys came out of the Avenue neighborhood, right, including you, who grew up in the Flanner House neighborhood.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible that that's part of the legacy of the Spinners, our local neighborhood Indiana Avenue is part of that group's legacy.
Exactly. Yeah.
We are listening back to our recent conversation with keyboardist Rodney Stepp and Alan Turk Burke of the Spinners. Stepp's keyboard work was featured on the 1975 album Spinners Live. We'll hear a track from that album in a moment, but first, let's hear Stepp's memories of that session.
Rodney, one thing I wanted to ask you about your time with the Spinners. You had a great opportunity in 1975 to be featured on a double live album the Spinners recorded at the Latin Casino, I think Philadelphia.
Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah. You had this great opportunity to be featured on this record. It was a hit record, particularly the track Mighty Love, which features an outstanding organ solo from you. Tell me about recording that album and kind of what that means to you to have your time in the group captured in such an incredible way.
Well, the first thing I'll say, I'll give homage to my brother here, the Turk, because when I got a chance to do that organ solo, I said, what would Turk do? And
you did very well in your
Well, thank you. But that was what put my name in the industry and kind of put me out there. I got to do a lot of sessions with a lot of people, you know, a lot of things behind the scenes nobody would ever know about, with Eddie Holland in L.A., with, you know, various other
producers.
You told
me Fred Wesley. You played a session.
Fred Wesley. I did a session with him in Los Angeles. Yes. There were several groups that I've had a chance to you know, do some things with, but man, reflecting on that, that was probably one of the best moments of my life, knowing that this album's really going to come out, that the world's going to hear it, and because of that, whether they know it or not, I'm on every track of that album. You know, I didn't write the music or that, this and that, but I'm on every track. So I could toot my horn and try to, you know, raise the bar on myself a little bit, right? It worked because I started getting different offers, you know, from different groups, different this and that. And I have to say that Felipe Wynn was the first one that encouraged me to do that. I wasn't playing an organ solo. I was just doing a little chopping and blocking and stuff, you know. And then one night, Felipe said, hey, man, I want you to hit me. I said, okay, what you want me to do? He said, you know, just do some of that little cute stuff that you be doing in rehearsals. Because in rehearsals, yeah. I be cutting up, you know. So Felipe encouraged me, and we started doing it. And the guys liked it. The audience liked it. Everybody seemed to start gravitating to it. So by the time we got the live album, I said, I'm going to act a fool. On this little three-chord little chick, I said, I'm going to figure out every kind of lick I can do in this one little three-bar little transition here. And that's what we did.
This is The Spinners with Mighty Love, featuring Rodney Stepp on organ.
Keep on looking, this you'll soon discover. My mighty love, just sometime later, we may know. My mighty love, take you sit all day by your telephone. Cause you're all alone, you need a mighty love. Hey, hey. Some say that you should do.
That was The Spinners with Mighty Love, featuring the Avenue music legend, Rodney Stepp. We've been listening back to our recent conversation with The Spinners keyboardist, Rodney Stepp, and Alan Turk Burke. In addition to working with The Spinners, Turk also toured with Marvin Gaye as part of the band Black Magic. In a moment, we'll listen to a classic Marvin Gaye track featuring Turk on keys. But first, let's hear Turk's memories of working with Marvin.
Before Fingers, you had Black Magic, which was a trio also, right? And at one point featured the Funky Buzzard, Dwayne Garvin, legendary drummer. You eventually become Marvin Gaye's backing band, played with him on the Midnight Special in Atlanta in 1974, a legendary concert. Tell me about Black Magic and how you ended up with Marvin Gaye at the height of his career.
Well, it actually started with the Spinners because once I left the Spinners, Joe Jackson had left with me, and actually Dolby had stayed with the Spinners for a while. Once we came back to town, Joe was living in Cleveland, and we put together Black Magic in Cleveland with a drummer there. And that was where you had only three people, and Joe sang too. So the drummer didn't sing, but we were doing a lot of songs that you would not expect three musicians to do. I'd always lived in Indianapolis, or during that time anyway, and Joe moved back to Indianapolis, and that's when we got with Dwayne Funky Buzzard Garvin. And, of course, he added a much heavier funk to what we were doing. So that was really nice. We used to play the End Zone over at 38th and Keystone, and we were pretty big deal over there. But LG Stover.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Who he had previously had a relationship with Marvin Gaye. And really, I mean, we were all kind of intertwined there. I mean, you know. I know, I'm sure you had a lot of contact with him up in Detroit when you were with the group. LG had told me that Marvin was getting ready to go back on tour. He hadn't done a live show for 5 years, although he continued to release songs. He had hit records, and he would do a TV performance where you do one song, but he did not do any touring. So he was going to tour again, and LG had recorded part of our performance, took it back to Marvin, and he hired Black Magic, and that was the basis of the rhythm section for Marvin Gaye for the tour that he did, you know, when he had the denim outfit with all the studs on it and the red skull cap, and, you know, we did that tour with him. When we got together, we went out to Hollywood, and he put us up in a hotel, and we rehearsed for a month over at Paramount Studios. And before rehearsal, well, let me back up even more from that, because Marvin would come over to the hotel where we were about 9:30, and we'd go out and play basketball. We play basketball for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then after that, we go over to Marvin's mother's house and eat. She would feed us. And then around 1 or 2 o'clock, we go over to the studio and rehearse till like 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, I did that for a month before we started touring, which we really got to be very close.
Recorded live in Atlanta in 1974, this is Marvin Gaye with Inner City Blues, featuring Alan Turk Burke on keys.
Thank you! Let's sing about the Inner City Blues, baby. I can get it out. Woo! Rockets! Jockets! Spend it on me. Honey, if I have not. Money, baby, we make it. Oh, see, you take it. Ooh, make me wanna holler, when it's doing my life.
Don't touch that dial. Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. On this week's show, we're looking back at some of our favorite interviews from 2023. Up next, we'll hear from the Indianapolis vocalist Debbie Nelson, known for her work in blues and soul music. Debbie has worked with many of Naptown's greatest musicians, including Jimmy Cole, Billy Wooten, and members of Funk Incorporated. She spent her early years in the Avenue neighborhood, attending Crispus Attucks High School and living in Lockville Gardens, a federal housing project built along the Avenue in 1938. Debbie spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long last year. Let's join their conversation.
And Debbie, you talked about the community of Lockfield being rich. Yes. You also grew up in an area that was culturally rich.
Yes.
You know, just outside your neighborhood were theaters, nightclubs, where some of the best musicians in the world were playing.
Yes.
At what point did you become aware of that? Is that something you knew about as a young girl, or is that something that as a teenager or maybe growing up you kind of realized you were in the middle of something really different?
I remember seeing... We always walked downtown, my mom and I, and we would pass by all the clubs. We'd go downtown on one side of the street and come back on the other, and I remember seeing the Pink Poodle, and I would try to peep in, come away from that door, come away from that window, just the place to play, all of these places that I would, the Downbeat, the Sunset, I would see those places, but I was more interested then in the lighty old theater where you paid to go in to see the one-legged woman or the hairy man, or Walker Theater where you paid 5 cents to get in and 10 cents for a box of good buttered popcorn with the bag greasy and 2 cents for the red lollipops on the little white cloth stick. Oh, I loved it. I didn't start really getting into music until one of the friends, one of the ladies I became friends with, she was older than me, and she was into music. And sometimes when I would be outside on the bench waiting for my mommy to come, and all the other kids' parents had called them in, most of them were single women with children, and would call them in, and I'd just be still sitting out there, and she used to come to the window and say, "Deborah, come on up here. Miss Bertha, you come up here and stay till Miss Bertha gets home. I cook some pork chops and some corn, you know, and just come up here and we'll look out far out the window, and then I'll let her know you're here and I'll walk you downstairs." Well, after a while of being up there with her, she started playing music. Well, I would listen to music. We would go to Mr. Tyler's little place, and he had a jukebox where you put a nickel in and you could play three songs. So I was would it be into it, but I wasn't really interested in spending my money on music. I wanted to get candy, anything sweet. I didn't want, nope, I'm not doing that one. So after a while, I became aware of when I would go in there, I would hear the music. So one day she called me up there, Rose, and she said, I'm thinking about putting a group together. Me and my sister, and how about you? We could do some songs. And I'm like, I don't think I can sing. And she's like, yeah, you can sing. You can just pitch in where you can. I remember one of the first songs we learned was Don't Mess With Bill. No, 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 no. The Marvelettes. And we practiced that song for months and months and months trying to get in tune. And we finally did. And then one day we appeared on a show and we had our little group together for about 6 months.
This group, it was the Tonettes, is mm-hmm. that right? And mm-hmm. Your neighbor was Rose Johnson, is
mm-hmm.
that her name?
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And this was a trio,
yes,
know, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And you were singing, like, at school events?
Yes.
You weren't going into clubs, were you?
No,
yeah,
uh-uh.
Yeah. Okay,
no,
okay.
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
School events. And I think we might have even done the Walker one time.
Okay. The Christmas
yeah.
show, probably.
He knows so much. Man, the Tonettes. I couldn't even think of that name. That's it.
In what year was it you started singing in clubs? You said you were 18.
Mm-hmm.
What year would
so
that have been?
So that would have been 67. Well, not long after I graduated. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 67 at
okay.
17.
Wow. So by 68, you
yeah.
were in the clubs.
Yes.
And it seems like you were successful very early on because, like you said, you had this residency at mm-hmm. Surfside 7.
Mm-hmm.
You were playing with very prominent musicians
yes.
in the city. What was it about you that was catching on so quickly with people?
I did a lot of Gladys Knight songs, Aretha Franklin songs, which were very popular then. I remember one particular night at Surfside, I did, and I still want to go back to doing that song, Gladys Knight's I Don't Want to Do Wrong. Oh, my goodness. And I sang that song, and I looked out there in the audience, because usually I'll sing with my eyes closed, and that's because I'm shy. And I looked out there at the audience, and there were men at the table with their women wiping their eyes, tears rolling down their face. And that just pushed me even more to just tear this song up, because then I'm feeling their hurt. And I had felt that hurt before, so I really got into it then. And I sang it through. I believe it was Bobby Watley and Jimmy Munsford that were playing it. And when I finished, I was so overcome with my own sadness that I had to go outside the club and stand and get some air. And I stood out there. I took my break out there. And then I remember Sue Ann Holland coming out, and she said, Debbie, you have to come back in. And I said, I am. I just need a break from this. I'm really trying to stop crying myself. And she said, no, you got to come back in now. I said, just give me about 5 more minutes. She said, no, you have to come now. They're going to tear my club down. And when she opened the door, you could hear them beating on the table with their glasses and, you know, whistling and all of this. And I was like, wow. And I had already, by the time I finished, I sang that song 4 times. I Don't Want to Do Wrong. It was amazing. That was truly amazing.
Don't wanna do wrong, but you've been gone away so long, and I hope you'll understand.
Probably your main group was with Bobby Watley, as
mm-hmm.
you mentioned, who was an organ player. Jimmy Munsford was
yes.
a drummer.
Oh,
these
yes.
were the guys that founded Funk Incorporated,
yes.
which went on to become a nationally known group with hit records.
Yes.
Bowlegs, Cool as Back. These were on the Billboard charts.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you get involved working with Bobby Watley in this basically an early version of Funk Incorporated?
And what was really weird is when I started working with Bobby Watley, he didn't even know how to play the organ. Mm. He had been a drummer. Mm. He didn't, and he had one of his friends bought him this nice, beautiful Hammett organ. And what's the three guys with the white hair?
King James Version.
Yes, the King James Version came in one night to set in. And Bobby was crazy about that organ. And so, you know, King James, he would jump all over the tables and with his Moses
staff,
and staff, and he would walk all over everywhere. And so one day I said, King James, get on the organ, get on the organ. I was always a prankster. I said, get up on the organ, get up on the organ. Bobby turned and looked at him. He said, if you do, I'll kill you right here on the stage. So King James averted that and came back down. But I was having a ball. But for him not knowing the organ and what he evolved into, it was amazing. And Jimmy Munsford is my favorite drummer ever. I still remember him playing a certain part in one of my songs, hitting that drum and then standing up and looking around everybody like, yeah, I'm the baddest. I am the baddest. And sitting back down right on time and going on through with that song. But when it got to him, he'd hit those drums and stand up and just do this. Yeah, it's me. It's me. I loved him. He and Bobby Watley, I loved them. They taught me so much. And they taught me important things, not only about music, but about life. I'm just a little girl out here flagging, don't know a whole lot about anything, naive. And they taught me so much. So I really stayed out of lots of trouble, never been in jail, never been in prison, never shot any drugs, none of that, because of what they taught me and what they shared with me.
You talked about the power of Jimmy Munsford's drums. Do you know what sampling is in these rap songs where they sample older songs and remix them?
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Munsford is probably one of the most sampled drummers in the history of rap music.
Really?
The Funk Incorporated music is used on some of the biggest hit records of the last 30 years.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's been sampled hundreds of times. You could name a famous rapper or R&B musician.
And they've used
his
drums.
Yeah, that's just part of the language of modern popular music, his drum break on a song called Cool Is Back, if you remember that record.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Some of those times I've heard things that would remind me of
It's him,
sure,
probably.
Sound like Jimmy Munsford.
It probably was.
Because no one could do it like he could do it. I was always so proud of him when he would just hit it and stand up.
Yeah.
And just, he would look around, shake his head, and look at each other like, I'm the baddest. And then sit back down, never miss a beat. Like, go, you go. I was so proud to be with them.
Yeah, when Funk Incorporated started taking off, and like I said, they were having hit records that were getting played on the radio, how did that make you feel? Were you excited for them?
Yes.
Did you want to be up there with them? How did you feel?
Excited for them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that today, but I'm really a homebody. And they think they have the perception that, oh, she loves to be out everywhere. No, I don't. When I'm not singing, I rarely go anywhere. I'm usually at home listening to gospel music. I love it. It comforts me. It calms me down.
We've been listening back to our 2023 conversation with the Indianapolis vocalist Debbie Nelson. Let's return to our conversation as Debbie discusses the legacy of Indiana Avenue.
And Debbie, in the 70s and 80s, this community that you grew up in, Lockfield Gardens, Indiana Avenue, it started to be dismantled by the city,
yes,
by IUPUI and different real estate developments that came in. You know, eventually, the people were forced out of Lockfield Gardens because they wanted to renovate it and turn it into student housing. A lot of the clubs you sang in as a young woman were just torn, demolished.
Yeah, down there.
Right. Whole neighborhoods were wiped out, wiped off the map. Churches wiped out. When this was happening, when this started happening, how did you feel about that? Did you kind of sense that the end was coming? Yeah, tell me.
It hurt inside, and it still hurts inside. There was a representation there in all the brick and mortar and the clubs and the little stores. And there was history there. There was blood there. It should not have been removed. And then to come up with an excuse when you get down to the last few buildings and say, oh, we misread it. We didn't know we weren't supposed to tear that much of it down. My daughter's father's building is one of the ones that you can still see off the avenue all the way up. He lived with his grandparents on the fourth floor. Mm. And every time I go down Indiana Avenue, I see that apartment building. I've shown it to my daughter and my grandchildren. That's where your father lived. That's where your grandfather lived. All the rich history that they destroyed, as if they had nowhere else to go, no other place to put them but to tear down something that was important to us, that meant a lot to us, that represented us, and everything about our life was torn to rubble. And I had a friend to move in one of the apartments after they updated them. And it was a one bedroom efficiency. And I went to visit her there one day. And I said, how much are you paying a month? $679 for this? Yeah. My heart was broken. And then to see the houses as you go towards 65 South up 11th Street, all those houses gone and the big, beautiful homes that replace them now that you can't even look at for less than $160,000. And I had to tell my daughter one day when she didn't want me to live where I live now. And she was always trying to get me to move. You know, and I'm comfortable where I am because where I am now reminds me of where I came from. These are the type of people I grew up with. These are the type of people who looked out for me. And that's where I feel most comfortable. And I'm not going until you take me out of there. And I'm getting ready to go to my father. And I've already explained that. You should get one of those houses that they got down there. I don't want those. They bought those houses for less than $1,000 from my people who thought $1,000 was a lot of money, and now they're selling them for $160,000 to $250,000. I wouldn't dare move over there if they gave me a house over there, because it's not just that simple. It's an insult to me that they would do that. Those are still a few that hung out. Jimmy Munsford's house was one of them. It was the little yellow house that used to sit there. And I think it might still be there. It was there long after the other new ones started coming up. And it's right before that apartment complex that's on the corner of Martin Luther King and comes west. I forget what the name of it is, but they've got this apartment house now. And his little yellow house was right there. And there's another little house there that didn't move. And I'm like, good for you. Good for you. You stay there. Let them build them all around you. But you stand your ground and you stay there. No, I would never disrespect my people by moving in there. Not after what they did to get it. No. Happy for them. But that's for them. I don't want any parts of it. That's sacred. Lockfield Gardens is sacred. It's sacred ground. And it should not have been destroyed like that. It should not have been. That's all I can say.
All these years later, right, there's still no significant recognition of the people, the entertainers, the artists who came from that neighborhood and who helped make Indianapolis world famous their creations. What do you make of that? And what would you like to see the city do to correct that?
I'm hoping that what you and the Indianapolis Arts Foundation is doing will be a start to the recognition that is deserving of those who contributed so much. It has to start somewhere. And that's why I'm so proud to know you. I'm so proud of you. And when I speak to people about you, I'm like, the wealth of knowledge this young man has about our music. That he cared enough to pour his heart into it and just soak up like a sponge everything that he could. And now he's putting it in action. It should have been done a long time ago. And I feel good about what's happening now. I never thought I would see that.
We've been listening back to our 2023 conversation with Debbie Nelson. Let's end with a classic track from Debbie Nelson and the In Full Transition Band. This is Castaway.
Broken and useless.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for listening to this look back at our favorite interviews and music of 2023. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcast. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
If you would stop and listen. listen, I will tell you a thing or two.